Ladies and gentlemen, please, those of you who can find a seat, grab one quickly, because there may be some more people coming who will run over the top of you if you haven't got one. My name's Mike McKellar. I'm the chairman of the AIIA in Victoria, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome such a great collection of people here tonight. We try and put on, as you know, if you just look at our program, the very best of speakers, and this proves it. There's no doubt about it. WikiLeaks has been a subject which has excited comment on all sides of the political spectrum, from those who advocate total openness to those who say, well, we're not too sure about this sort of thing. Some of the revelations that have been made public have been quite frank, and those who are involved in them would, I'm certain, feel somewhat aggrieved that what they were thought they were saying in private has hit the public domain. We're very lucky that we've got Paul Barrett, AO, speaker here tonight, because Paul, he's done it all. He's a former Secretary of the Defence Department and former Deputy Secretary of DFAT, apart from a lot of other things. He spent 40 years knowing secrets, keeping secrets, talking about secrets in his many roles in his many departments. There couldn't be anybody who really we could call upon to give us more of an inside look at what this all means. We were very lucky a week or so ago to have Ambassador Bleich from the US ambassador here in Melbourne. And he gave us a remarkably forensic address on WikiLeaks. And if ever I get into really bad trouble, I'd love to have him as a lawyer on my side. But he's the recipient of the secrets, and of some of the secrets at least. But Paul Barrett has been right in the middle of it for so many years. So Paul's been here a few times before, and we're really genuinely delighted to welcome him back and to address us tonight on how WikiLeaks changed the world. Would you please welcome Mr. Paul Barrett.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming here tonight, and thank you for turning up in such large numbers to hear me speak about WikiLeaks. Well, WikiLeaks is a surprisingly large subject, and I don't propose to go through the revelations themselves, although I will show you some of them to make a particular point. I'd rather want to go to the more structural issues about what WikiLeaks has done and is likely to do in the future. So the sort of issues I'd like to cover are the tensions that exist between secrecy and openness, the criteria for national security classification of documents. Have the cables revealed anything new? There are lots of things that we saw in the newspapers. We thought, well, yeah, we knew that already. I mean, is it a startling revelation that Kevin Rudd's a micromanager? So is there anything new in any of this? Have the releases put lives at risk or otherwise done harm? Because that was an initial claim. What do the leaks reveal about our own particular political leaders? Is there anything we can find out about them from looking at what the cables say? Will large-scale leaks become a permanent feature of the political and diplomatic landscape? And finally, will the WikiLeaks phenomenon transform the way governments do business with each other, which is the subject hinted at in the title of the presentation? So there's an obvious tension between democracy and national security norms. Democracy demands openness for a number of things, for informed decision-making. If we're to make decisions about our leaders and about our leaders' decisions, we need to know the background and the context. An argument for openness. And also for accountability. How can we know how to assess them if we don't know what they've done, and again, if we don't know what all the background is? So openness is fundamental to a democratic system. On the other hand, secrets are fundamental to the preservation of national security. There are all sorts of things that governments would rightly regard as national security secrets. Military technology. By the way, don't be too distracted by the death by PowerPoint. I've prepared a fairly complete set of slides so that the Institute can do what it wishes with them, and they're self-explanatory to someone who reads them without hearing the speech. So if you close your eyes, you'll get all the message from what I say. Military plans. The capability and readiness state of the various elements of the Australian Defence Force. Our intelligence techniques. How good are we at gleaning intelligence? How do we go about doing it? The countermeasures we might take, either intelligence countermeasures or military countermeasures. What would we do if our adversaries did thus and so? Those are important secrets. Now, there's clearly a tension between these two. I would argue in an open democratic society, you have to start with a presumption of openness. And then you justify the secrecy on the basis of clear criteria. And that is, in fact, what we do in practice. Sometimes the practice departs a bit from the theory, but there are clear criteria for applying national security classification. I'm using that phrase, national security classification, advisedly for a reason I'll explain in a moment. First thing is, we classify something as top secret if we say that it's becoming known would do exceptionally grave damage to national security. And by exceptionally, I mean exceptionally grave damage. This stuff is really hot, and therefore, by definition, there's not much of it. Secret is grave damage to national security, confidential damage or prejudice to national security, and restricted is simply undesirable effects if released. And that's equivalent to the US classification government use only. Now, within that framework, there's obviously very special handling at the top and much less special handling at the bottom. So there are costs and time involved in applying a high national security classification. Top secret information is typically carried around by retired military officers or policemen in briefcases that are chained to their wrist, and restricted, one permissible means of communicating restricted information is to put a stamp on an envelope and drop it in the nearest letterbox. So it's which shows that defence may have more faith in Aussie Post than some of us. Very important point is that the potential for administrative embarrassment is not grounds for national security classification. Now, when I was a lad, it actually was. One of the definitions of confidential in the 60s was that its release may cause administrative embarrassment. But what's happened between the 60s and now is we have freedom of information legislation, quite rightly and properly, and you can't have a national security classification that has to do with administrative embarrassment living alongside freedom of information legislation, because no court would deem that a government had properly withheld information from an FOI request on the ground that it was embarrassing to the government to release it. So that one's gone, that one's dead. And it's very important to remember that when you read the cables that have been published, most of which are about confidential, and they're reporting on conversations which have taken place, and quite a number of them pretty ordinary stuff. Now, we've had contradictory, just before I go on, there have been contradictory reactions to the WikiLeaks. First of all, boring, nothing new, it's all old news. We all knew that. On the other hand, lives have been put at risk. This is the end of civilization we know of. How can governments do business with each other in this new environment? Now, there's a bit of a tension between some of those propositions. So the first one I'd like to address is whether there's anything new here. There's a gent named Greg Mitchell who's the blogger for The Nation in the United States. And since the release of the WikiLeaks, he has been what he calls live blogging. So he's in day number 88 of every few minutes saying, a cable on this has been released. Senator so-and-so has denounced Julian Assange in the Congress. Sarah Palin's demanded that he be hunted down and shot like a dog. Now, all that sort of stuff, so more or less minute by minute. Our good old Greg is in day number 88. And a couple of weeks ago, he published a list of key revelations. So I just want to dispose of the proposition that there's nothing new. So see if any of this strikes you as new. First of all, Saudi donors remain the chief financiers of Sunni militant groups like Al-Qaeda. That wasn't new to me. I think that one's always been known. What is perhaps new is the fact that this is in official communications between US embassies and Washington. That this is we now know it is officially known in Washington that this is the case. Saudis and some other Middle Eastern states pressed the US to take stronger action against Iran. So I didn't know that the King of Saudi Arabia was telling the Americans to give Iran a belting. The Yemeni president lied to his own people, claiming his military carried out airstrikes on militants, which were actually done by the US. This was part of giving the US a free hand. So what you had here was between the president of Yemen, who seems to not be travelling well at the moment, and the United States, there was a deal concocted to say, you blokes can do what you like in this country, and I'll say it was our own military that did it. Shocking levels of US spying at the United Nations beyond what was commonly assumed. So everybody assumed there was some of it going on, but we didn't know, saying sort of see if you can get hold of their credit card numbers and what else you can find out about it, and that this was going on all around the world. The US tried to get Spain to curb its probes of Gitmo torture and rendition, and what we also found out was that Spanish officials were actually collaborating with the Americans rather than their own government to procure this outcome. Now, there was a similar story, not about the misbehaviour of officialdom, but a similar story about the US applying acute pressure to the Germans to not press the case of a German citizen with a Muslim name who was taken off to a special rendition site, thumped within an inch of his life, found to be the wrong person. So he was criminally abducted from a street in Germany. Found to be the wrong person, so he was dumped in Albania and left to find his own way home. Now, the Americans thought it was very small-minded of the German government to want to pursue this, and they managed to persuade the Germans that was so. The cable showed that the UK promised in 2009 to protect US interests in the official Chilcot inquiry on the start of the Iraq War. Now, we all thought that was an open, proper royal commission that was just after the facts, but don't worry, fellas, we'll look after you. American and British diplomats fear Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, with its poor security, could lead to fissile material falling into the hands of terrorists or to a devastating nuclear exchange with India. Now, I follow nuclear developments reasonably closely, and what I'd always read was that, sure, there's instability in Pakistan, but don't worry, the Pakistani military's got this one right under control, and it's getting a lot of advice from the Americans, and there's nothing for us to worry about. What's happening in the official communications is there's a great deal to worry about. Washington was misled by its own diplomats on the Russia-Georgia showdown. That's a good one. The UK sidestepped a ban on housing cluster bombs. Officials concealed from Parliament how the US is allowed to bring weapons onto British soil in defiance of a treaty. So there's a treaty that says you can't have cluster bombs here. The British officials say, look, there's a way around this, and we won't tell anyone. So that one's a bit new, I think. Iraqi government officials see Saudi Arabia, not Iran, as the biggest threat to the integrity and cohesion of their fledgling democratic state. I'm using Greg Mitchell's own words in all of these. Well, did you know that? The UK is training death squads in Bangladesh. That's an interesting one too. There's something called the Rapid Action Battalion, which has a habit of killing young men at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, the Brits' explanation for this is it's all human rights training, but the Bangladeshi say, we don't know anything about any human rights training. So there's something interesting going on there. A cable shows Israel cooperating with Mahmoud Abbas versus Hamas during the Gaza attacks. The Israelis told the Americans they wanted to bring Gaza to the brink of collapse, and the US Secret Service has used Turkey as a base to transport terrorism suspects as part of its extraordinary rendition program. So that's just a list to dispose of the idea that there was nothing new. So the next question is, were lives put at risk? There's no reliable report that I'm aware of WikiLeaks revelations having caused substantial harm. No report of a particular person having been dealt with as a result of the revelations. And the State Department has conceded as much quite recently, because they can't say what harm has been done. And I think that's just in the nature of the fairly routine embassy reporting that we're seeing in most of the content. I'd also argue that if lives have been put at risk, the primary responsibility for that lies with the originators of the cables. First of all, it's very unusual to name human intelligence sources. There's absolutely no need for someone to know the name of a human intelligence source. It's actually much more useful to have the sort of descriptors that appear on this kind of intelligence material, which says, let's say, a reliable source with good access. And that tells you two things. We've used this person, we had information from this person before and it's proved to be reliable. Secondly, this person is in a position to know this information. Whereas if it's Abdul bin Aziz, what does that tell anyone? But it names the person and has a great risk for them. So the name of the source would normally be known only to the individual and the immediate interface, and it starts getting very, very carefully protected after that. If there's any necessity to name the source, as it may be if you want to say, look, this is the Minister for Defence in this regime, you may want to disclose that. But that would mean that information would be very highly classified, very highly compartmentalised, and be a very, very limited number of people. Now, what these cables came from was a State Department intranet to which 3 million people had access. Now, how secret is something? I mean, this is an army private in, allegedly, let me stress, allegedly, an army private in Baghdad downloaded all this stuff about what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Saudi Arabia, what's happening in Australia, and so on and so forth. So, and this was an overreaction to 9/11. The FBI and CIA got really belted for failure to join up the dots, which was really about very competitive refusal to share vital information. But the official reaction was, well, you bastards won't share anything, so we'll show you, we'll make you share everything. And when he was Secretary of State, Colin Powell was, against his better judgment, I think, agreed that all of the State Department's cables could be put into this Pentagon-run intranet. So there's really just absolutely extraordinary levels of access to it by quite junior people. So anyone who originated a cable that had the name of someone who'd be in peril if the name got out, originated a cable knowing it was going to be available to 3 million junior people, really. I don't think we can hold that one at Mr. Assange's door. So let's move on to what the WikiLeaks cables reveal about our political leaders. And I'd like to suggest that the initial revelation certainly brought out their authoritarian instincts and their capacity for hyperbole. They also show that our leaders deal very incautiously with friendly countries such as the United States and Israel. And finally, that they routinely lie to us. Aside from that, everything's fine. So let's deal with the authoritarian reactions of our leaders. Prime Minister and Attorney General immediately denounced the leaks as illegal, and they appointed an AFP-led task force to discover a crime. Now, this is a fairly unusual legal sequence of events, that you say, this bastard's committed a crime, and I'm going to appoint a high-level group to find out what crime it is. Because what we normally do is we become aware of a crime, and we set people to work to find out who committed it. Well, good old Julian's committed a crime and we're going to find out what it is. Very embarrassingly, it only took days for the AFP to report back that they could not identify any offence under Australian law. So Cyclone WikiLeaks was downgraded from illegal to grossly irresponsible. But always with the caveat that someone's committed a crime. You've got to remember there was a crime here somewhere. Now, we can't pin it on Julian, but nevertheless, there's crime. And the government failed to respond to calls for extrajudicial action against Julian Assange. You had people running around the United States, Vice President Biden saying he's a cyber terrorist, 24 hours after he'd said, well, really, there's no harm being done. And you had Palin saying the sorts of things she was saying, and various other people from the Republican right suggesting that that he should simply, if we can't prove he committed a crime, we should just kill him, basically. The other thing is the government persists with the myth that WikiLeaks dumped 250,000 cables onto the internet. Now, at the time that the first law officer of the Crown was running around saying that, less than 1% of the cables had been made public, and it's still a tiny, tiny proportion of it. At the time the government was fulminating about this, the only cables that had been released had actually been first published by reputable newspapers like the New York Times, El Pais, Der Spiegel, The Guardian, and Le Monde, because the first... Until some relationships broke down, the first thing that WikiLeaks did was say to these newspapers, here are these cables, you're the professional reporters of news, you sift through this, you think about the cables that would do unnecessary harm, you write it up in a way with your professional skills that does it. So after the cables were... The content of the cables was published and they were put up on the newspaper websites, then a day or two later, basically Assange would give them an exclusive on a number of cables, and then a day or two later they'd be published on WikiLeaks. And there's still a very, very small proportion of the cables that we've seen. But every chance he gets, Attorney General says, and the Prime Minister, irresponsibly dumped 250,000 cables on. Leaders dealing incautiously with friendly countries. I have to say that the conversations, I've read carefully through all the cables that were published at one stage by The Age, that were US Embassy Canberra cables. And I have to say that we don't see much from the coalition parties, but the members of the Labor Party that interacted with the American Embassy seemed to forget that they were dealing with foreign powers who each might diverge from ours. They regarded these people as friends, and therefore you share your insights with them willy-nilly, whereas in fact there are times when we have very serious business to transact and we need to keep our cards a little closer to our chest. Then opposition leader Kim Beazley, now our ambassador in the United States, said to the US ambassador at the time, Australia will support the US in Afghanistan until hell freezes over. That seems to me to close off any possibility of us at some stage saying our interests in Afghanistan diverge from those of the United States. And as we did in Vietnam, for example, we withdrew from Vietnam before the United States decided the game was up. But Beazley said, no, this is what's required by the ANZUS Treaty. So there's no elbow room there to say, well, we don't see it that way. You pre-declare that we must. He also said, in the event of a war between the United States and China, why would you want to be talking about this? Australia would have absolutely no alternative but to line up militarily beside the United States. That seems to close off a few pretty important options. Mark Abib was briefing the US. The way I've expressed this might be a bit rough on Abib, but he was, by the middle of 2008, Rudd was elected in November 2000, by the middle of 2008, Abib's in discussions with the United States about Julia Gillard as his successor. Now, he's 70-odd percent in the polls, and we're talking about who his successor is going to be and how she's the most pragmatic politician in Australia and all that. And the American must have wondered, what's the secret message here? And then by February 2008, that's like a year and a half before the deed was done, he's saying, oh, Rudd runs a dysfunctional office and he's a micromanager and he's driving everyone nuts and he keeps asking foreign affairs to do so much work that they're all run ragged and can't do work to appropriate quality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I put it to you that the standing and authority of our political leader is always a key asset in the conduct of our international relations. It may very well be. You would normally assume and hope that... our foreign minister and a prime minister who insists on having his hands firmly on foreign policy would be negotiating with the friendliest of states that things that they would be reluctant to do. That's just part of the business of international transaction. Now, if the ambassador can say, well, look, you don't want to give this concession to Kevin Rudd, but just keep patting the ball over the net. You know, he mightn't be around for long, so you might be able to just keep this ball in play for long enough to not have to give that concession. So this is a very unwise way to be talking, to be communicating to foreign embassies that the ground's shifting under the feet of our Prime Minister. Really, most unwise. Now, we surprised the Israeli ambassador. He told the Americans that, well, first of all, he told the Americans that Rudd was deeply worried that Iran's intransigence means that the window for a diplomatic solution is closing and that Israel may feel forced to use non-diplomatic means. So Rudd's saying, I'm worried that they're going to force you to use undiplomatic means. That sounds to me like a pretty clear message that if you choose to conduct a unilateral military attack on Iran, we won't say anything. That's my read of that. On the invasion of Gaza, the Israeli ambassador was pleasantly surprised to find that acting Prime Minister Gillard was much more supportive than they'd expected. So our failure to say anything at all came as a surprise to the Israelis. And they were just plain surprised to find that the then Foreign Minister Stephen Smith was on a holidays and didn't want to get involved. In fact, the Israeli ambassador went on to say to the US ambassador that Australia is so supportive of Israel that they're a critical part of our global PR battle because we can keep saying, well, the Australians think this is fine. And so I would suggest we've sold the pass. The bottom line of these uncompromising statements of support is we've left no elbow room for present or future governments to consider what support, if any, we would provide to the US or Israel on any given matter in the light of the circumstances of the day. We've already made it quite clear we're with you, right or wrong, basically. And so they can take us completely for granted on key issues. I would suggest that what we should always do with the friendliest of states is maintain a certain amount of creative tension so that they need to find out from us how we would respond to what they propose to do, and we have some leverage to argue and seek to dissuade them away from a course of action or to moderate a course of action or to do it slightly differently or to do it very differently. But when we say, look, we're on side, you don't have to worry about us, we're really giving a lot away. No leverage on their behaviour. The reduced effectiveness of our embassy in Tehran was something that emerged from the cables, that we were seen as so much part of the American-Israeli cheer squad that there was retaliation just to make life difficult for our embassy in Tehran. Now, it happened that in 1979 I was the acting secretary of the Department of Trade when the government decided that we should pull all non-essential personnel out of Tehran, not in response to the first revolution in February 79, but really as things got worse during 79. And I wasn't prepared to ask any of the trade commissioners to stay, but the junior trade commissioner volunteered to stay. He said, and I accepted, that it would be very good for us to maintain the continuity of business as usual right through that relationship. And we invested in the 70s, 80s, early 90s, we invested a lot in differentiating ourselves. Yes, we're an ally of the United States, but we make our own decisions. We can talk to the regime in Tehran and actually be more useful to our ally in that capacity because we're actually on the ground, they're not, and we can have conversations they can't have. Now, we have so much sold the pass. Alexander Downer and Kevin Rudd both have to accept responsibility for that, that we've reduced our capacity actually to be a player in this. And I suggest all that's not in our interest and that perhaps middle power diplomacy should have been engaged to work for a grand bargain which seeks to resolve Iran, Israel, Palestine issues, and I think you're not going to resolve any of two sides of that triangle until you resolve all three in one, put them all in one pot. And we're not here to discuss that tonight. I'll come back and talk about it. Okay, my third proposition is that our governments routinely deceive us. The cables make clear to me that our national leaders use the shelter of national security classification to conceal from the public their real assessments and motives and the advice that they're receiving from our intelligence agencies, well, from their intelligence agencies. And this behaviour is unconscionable. Now, as I've said at the start, there are valid national security grounds for governments to withhold certain types of information, but I don't believe they're entitled to deceive us. They can say, you may not know, but they should not lie to us. Okay, let's deal with Iran. The cable from the US Embassy report on a conversation between Peter Varghese and the head of ONA at the time. He's now our High Commissioner in India. He said that ONA viewed Tehran's nuclear program within the paradigm of the laws of deterrence and that it's a mistake to think of Iran as a rogue state. Now, that's not too far from the formal national intelligence estimates made by the United States, particularly at that 2008 time, Dennis Blair as the supreme head of, sitting across all the US intelligence agencies, said that it was not clear that Iran was embarked on a nuclear weapons program. Now, he went on to say he thought they probably would at some stage, but that he felt at that time they had not decided. So we arrived independently at assessments that aren't too far from theirs. But Rudd and Gillard governments have simply echoed the public US-Israeli views on the Iranian nuclear program, that of course they're weaponising and they're an existential threat to Israel and all that stuff. When have you ever heard one of our government leaders say to us that it's a mistake to think of Iran as a rogue state? So they haven't told us I'm not expecting them to publish our ONA's intelligence estimates, but they don't tell us that their official advice has a much calmer view of all this than the way they're presenting it. There was provocative commentary, and in my view, quite unnecessary commentary about China in the Defence White Paper. I think the Defence White Paper should have talked about the capabilities we need to be the dominant military power in our own immediate region, that is the traditional model of saying we need to control the sea air gap between us and the islands chained to our north, and we don't have to postulate who the enemy might be. But anyway, it was there. The Australian public was told, no worries. China's quite relaxed about this. There's no problem at all. Now, what the WikiLeaks cable shows is that Mike Pezzullo, the principal author of the paper, was given a great dressing down in Beijing. And the Chinese Foreign Ministry at Vice Minister level was saying, if you don't change this, they were showing the draft. If you don't change this, Australia will have to suffer the consequences. Well, we were never told any of that. We were told it just wasn't a problem. Kevin Rudd publicly opposed the deployment of US ballistic missile defences, but privately told the US we were on board. So that's a classic case of saying, look, just for domestic political reasons, I'll have to make a bit of noise about this, but you needn't take it seriously. Well, what sort of behaviour is that? Typical behaviour, but... The most serious example is Afghanistan. This is a very serious example for a number of reasons. Publicly, all NATO countries will tell you that things are going well, we're making progress, probably, perhaps not as much as we'd like, but we're making progress. Things are on track. Well, privately, in October... Oh, right. Rudd told a visiting US congressional delegation the national security establishment in Australia was very pessimistic about the long-term prognosis for Afghanistan. He went on to say also, Afghanistan scares the hell out of me. But this is advice about what is the assessment of the national security establishment in Australia, is very pessimistic about the prognosis. And that was... obviously still the case in 2009 because former Defence Secretary Rick Smith referred in a cable to the train wreck that the Australian Federal Police have to deal with in working with the Afghan National Police. Well, have you ever heard that? Until WikiLeaks. Because all that I've ever heard is, well, we're making progress and things are going well and we're going to train the Afghan National Police and hand over security responsibilities to them. Now, I think the most serious consequence of this is the failure to disclose the real situation means there's no possibility of an honest national debate about the situation and what to do. And I'd like to just take you back to World War II. When Churchill became Prime Minister in May 1940, And in those early and desperate years, he was actually levelled with the British people. He said in May 1940, there were people who said we should conclude a peace with Hitler and just retreat to our sceptred isle. Churchill was for fighting on. But he said, I can offer you nothing but blood, toil, tears and sweat. It's not going to be fun. It's going to be bloody dreadful. And when there was the prospect, the real prospect of an invasion of England, he said, we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the landing grounds, we'll fight them in the hedgerows, we'll fight them in the hills. It was a thoroughly unattractive prospect, of, in effect, a poorly armed British public just resisting to the last. And even after the splendid victory at Alamein, he said, this isn't the end, it isn't even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. Now, what that revelation of the state, and there were plenty of the church, obviously, plenty of Churchill didn't tell the British public, but what that open statement about the state of affairs meant is that you can tell people what sacrifices are demanded of, you can mobilise for war, you can organise for war. And my problem with us all being fed bromides about how things in Afghanistan are going well is that it closes off any possibility of our leaders here or elsewhere in the NATO environment saying, we've got a real problem in Afghanistan, and in order to achieve victory, whatever victory might be, these are the things we need to do. What's really going on is that they're all just hoping that we can go on with this stuff until it's someone else's watch. So as long as we don't lose on my watch, it's okay. Now, I think that's frankly pretty dreadful. Now, we're coming towards the end and have some discussion of my fairly forthright remarks. Will large-scale leaks become a permanent feature of the political and diplomatic landscape? And I think the answer to that has to be in the affirmative. Partly because the mass leaks are technology-driven. They happen because they can. We're so far past the days when some poor bugger who's probably being blackmailed had to slip into a room and get the reading lamp over the desk and photograph pages one at a time and then try to sneak out with the camera in his pocket. Now you just bring in a blank CD inside a Lady Gaga cover and can take away gigabytes of data, a blank DVD, obviously. So the technology just makes it so much easier to... And plus the creation of large-scale intranets. All of that just creates a totally different environment for the theft of secrets. And that's evidenced by the subsequent emergence of the Palestine Papers, which had nothing whatever to do with WikiLeaks. They've come from a quite different source. And this was pretty interesting too. The MI6 helpfully staffed the Middle East so-called peace talks, which the Palestine Papers reveal are a complete charade, and produced verbatim transcripts. So we'd have a very clear record of what everybody said to everybody all the time, and now they're all out in the public domain and they're a mighty embarrassment. A really history-making event, but nothing to do with Julian Assange and whoever his source might be. And again, that bunch of documents demonstrated the grand deception that the peace talks were never going anywhere. And the deceptiveness of governments is an underlying driver for these leaks. Go back to the Pentagon Papers, and I remember a few celebrated leaks. There was one about Vietnam that was a mighty embarrassment to Whitlam. And the motivation for that was just a single cable or two cables. But the motivation, again, was a public lie which someone in foreign affairs was, the Department of Foreign Affairs was horrified enough to say, the bastard, that's not true, and stick it in Laurie Oakes's letterbox or whatever the case may be. But the motivation is the government's lying to us, people should know, so there's the two things, the technology and the righteous indignation of officers in the know. So how, if they have WikiLeaks changed the world? I think in a way we're witnessing something like two galaxies in collision, you know, massive sort of but slow-moving process. The hot swirling mass of diplomatic communications is in collision with the fast-moving rapidly changing and supremely adaptable mass of the internet. And there can't be one end to that. The latter will devour the former, and governments are just going to have to get used to that. So what does that mean? There have been extravagant claims to the effect that governments won't be able to communicate with each other as frankly as they did in the past. The diplomats and officials will have to be very cautious about writing anything down. And the facts are, governments have to communicate with each other. I mean, I go back to the late 70s when Freedom of Information, which I referred, legislation came in, and there were all sorts of people running around government offices saying, oh, this is the end of civilization, we know it all. I'm never going to write anything down again. My reaction was actually, you should write more down, because if documents are discoverable, I want to be hanged for what I actually did and said, and not for what someone incorrectly misunderstood I didn't say. But anyway, that's just my personal reaction to it. But the fact is, governments have to communicate with each other. And for those communications to be fully effective, both the instructions and the records have to be written down fully and accurately and communicated to those who need them. And we don't just have aimless conversations between ambassadors and senior officials or prime ministers or foreign ministers. Cables come from capital saying, please go in and communicate the following points, or please go in and ask about this, and then a report has to go back. Now, the person who receives that report, the first person who receives the report is going to be a communicator, it's going to be someone who operates the communication machinery. That report has to go to people who need to know it and need to act on it. So none of that's going to change at all. And frankly, the want of frankness has been with the public rather than between governments. I think governments, particularly friendly governments, are actually quite frank. What they do is they frankly agree that they'll lie to their respective publics. So the want of frankness has been the communication to the public about what the case may be. So again, you can conceive of, well, you saw the case of Kevin Rudd and the ballistic missiles. I have to make a bit of a fuss about this, but we're on board, don't worry. So I doubt that WikiLeaks will have, the bottom line is, I doubt that WikiLeaks will have much impact on the logistics of the modus operandi between governments. They will communicate, there will be written communications, there will be written records, and they'll continue to be, we'll tighten up the 3 million, but they'll continue to be spread around the desks of people who need information. I think they've changed the world already in a sense that there's a good argument that they've played a role in triggering the mass movement sweeping the Arab world and re-stimulating protest in Iran. Some of what's been revealed has played out very badly in the Arab street. More subtly, they've triggered a lot of questions about the relationships between the West and repressive Arab regimes. There's a lot of red faces in Western capitals about what's been revealed about relationships between the Tunisian regime, Mubarak, what have you. And that leads to increased accountability. So it's clear, what I think the most important result is, it's clear to me that the potential for large-scale leaks has greatly raised the political risk of democratic leaders deceiving their publics. And if the leaders are obliged to be more honest with their publics, then they will on occasions have to be less accommodating to friendly governments. And this will be a healthy development, because bilateral discussions and negotiations with friendly countries will have to be much more about finding positions that are acceptable to both sides, rather than just agreeing to go quietly and we'll tell some other story to our public. You'll have to, if you're going to have to communicate honestly with your public, you're going to have to drive a harder line with the people you're talking to. That's my basic conclusion. And democratic governments are clearly going to have to deal more cautiously with repressive regimes. And that's about it.
Right, who would like to start the questioning? Julian.
Julian Briggs, I'm a member of the street. You said that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange didn't dump 250,000 cables. They chose what they distributed. And then you've spent the best part of an hour being fairly critical of the US, the UK, Australia, Israel. I didn't catch a mention of Russia, North Korea. The only mention of China was China were offended by a white paper. The only mention of Iran was two mentions that Iran was less of a threat than generally thought. Do you think that Julian Assange would feel that
Well, I can only talk about what cables Julian Assange had, which came from the United States. If and when he gets cables from Russia, China, or Iran, we'll be very interested to see what they say. He would represent himself as standing in the publishing marketplace to be the passive recipient of leaks. He says he developed a technology that enables people to leak things to him anonymously. He says he does not know that it is Bradley Manning. He doesn't know who it is that leaked those cables. It happened that those cables came to the United States. Now, I infer from your question that you think I've done the West a disservice by, in a sense, I've been a tool of Julian Assange because I've criticised the United States, Israel, and our own government and have failed to criticise those others. I don't think that the reference point for the standards of behaviour we expect from the governments we elect should be the fact that China, Russia or others might behave more badly.
Can I just follow up there? I wasn't commenting on your interpretation, I was commenting on the information
that's been made about it. Now, I would think that Julian Assange would have some very serious questions to answer if we ever learned that he had received leaks from other oppressive regimes and had withheld them. But I don't think we can, for precisely the reason in which he finds himself, we can't expect him to be soliciting leaks. What the government of the United States and probably our own would desperately like is to be able to find some way of distinguishing him from the rest of the mainstream media. And if it ever turned out that he had asked someone in the US system to get hold of these cables or had assisted them in any way and had not been a completely passive recipient, I think he would find himself in very, very severe difficulty under the US Espionage Act. So he can't go shopping for leaks. All he can do is say, here's my site. If you've got something that you think might be interesting, put it on my site and we'll have a look at it.
Other questions? Right down the back.
Hi, I'm a member of AAA. I was just wondering, could fear of leakage lead to people that are leaders being cautious from approaching associates and therefore making less informed decisions and therefore worse?
I guess there's always that risk, but there's always been the risk of retail leaks. There have always been retail leaks. I mean, I can tell you a couple of real national security leaks, both of which appeared in Australian mainstream media and were never followed up. One was as we were about to send unarmed policemen into Timor for the referendum, the plebiscite. Someone thought it'd be a really good idea to publish in the Age an article that said that we're immensely clever because we can listen in on the mobile phone conversations of the Indonesian military in East Timor. And we knew that they were that elements of the Indonesian military in East Timor were organising the militias. And just as those unarmed policemen went in there, we lost that source of intelligence. Now, there's a very widespread view within the Defence Department that we knew exactly which member of ministerial staff leaked that, but it's an allegation to make, and what can you prove? How do you prove it? But that's what I call leaking a national security secret. And there was another one about intelligence gathering effort of against a very important embassy in Canberra, and the technical means of doing that were published in the mainstream media, and we lost that forever. So there have always been leaks. So I guess people need to think about that. But look, I think after a bit of heightened awareness, people are just going to go back into their old ways. It's like people forget there's a microphone. 10 minutes up into a conversation, people forget there's a microphone on the table, and I think people will go on seeking counsel, seeking information, and discussing information pretty much the way they've always done.
Zara.
Zara Kimson, NMA. What's the difference, really, between Harold Holt saying all the way with LBJ out loud, compared with what you're talking about, people, Kevin Rudd or Ken Beasley, saying things in private, but you said that was sort of, we lost our ability to have leverage with America about certain things. I mean, what is really the difference?
No substantive difference. We lost our leverage when we sat all the way with LBJ as well. Why would you ever say that? I mean, if you wanted to be a sentient polity that actually transacts meaningful business in the real world, why would you ever say we're with you come hell or high water? Where's the upside in that?
Right down the back there.
I'll come back.
Would you speak up, please?
I'm wondering, thinking about whether or not Julian Assange has made a big difference to our society, I'm wondering if it's a marker that Western democracies, that the populaces of Western democracies, are now so highly educated that they want open government, they expect a lot from government, they expect honesty, and he's sort of showing that it's possible in his sort of terms. Whether it is possible after seeing what you've been listening and discussing, and we need to have bureaucracies which need to have some confidence that they can talk to one another, I don't know, but I do think that there is this demand in the people themselves through general education and through financial stability.
I think there is a general demand for honesty, but I think much of the public is disengaged from foreign affairs, so they assume that our governments know what they're doing and are keeping us in the picture. I would just make the comment on something you said.
Excuse me, we didn't in Vietnam. The public went out into the streets.
Yeah. We did, and many people marched in favour of the idea that invading Iraq was a very bad idea and it didn't make any difference either. And again, that's another case of dishonesty. I am convinced that not later than mid-2002 we had committed ourselves to the invasion of Iraq, and John Howard was saying that right up to the eve of the invasion. And I think what he was saying to the Americans was, I have to be able to say that no decision being made. And he was making some very technical point about there's some piece of paper he hasn't yet signed. But we had people embedded in the planning process in Tampa, Florida. Now, you don't get embedded in the detailed military planning on spec and turn around after it's all over and say, oh, look, we've decided we're not sure this is a good idea. So I think we were committed from the time he went to Washington about mid-2002, I think we'd given a commitment. So we don't get a lot of honesty, but I think the public has been prepared to, the general public's been prepared to take government too much on trust in relation to Iraq. But just to pick up something else I think you were hinting at with Assange, I think I don't think the world can survive with the level of openness that Julian Assange might be looking for, where I think he and some of his associates think that nothing should be secret. Now, I would argue very strongly there are things that must be secret that are legitimately secret, but the right to deceive is not wrapped up in that.
Sure. I'm a bit uncomfortable about the IAP having a look at this and finding there's no real case. I've taken a theoretical view that Assange has actually stolen classified information. And I went through your definitions. They are Australian definitions, not the American definitions.
Pretty much the same. Who did he steal them from?
The American government.
He stole them?
Well, he received them. And
he received something that someone else has stolen?
Yeah.
Correct. And I also believe that this guy didn't quite give information for free, but I can't possibly prove it.
And
I'm surprised that isn't an offence somewhere.
Well, I was always surprised at that when I was Secretary of Defence. I was surprised that there wasn't an offence to publish this bloody thing in The Age. But if you say that was an offence, Why aren't we getting after the editors of all the mainstream newspapers? And that's what governments are desperately trying to do. They're desperately trying to find some respect in which Julian Assange is different from the mainstream media.
We've got a law. Covers this.
Seems like it. So that door might be closed after now that the horse has bolted. But the problem is that sort of law comes hard up against the First Amendment in the United States. So you'll get enormous pushback if you try to say that the New York Times is not allowed to publish unauthorised information that the person not authorised to disclose. And there are times when those disclosures are really critical to the health of the society. It's a very big decision for anyone to make to decide that I am a person who knows what's good for our society. That's a bit of a problem too. But there are times when disclosure is very important.
Very much for a very secluded feel about the media.
Could you speak up a little bit?
I'd love to say, first of all, I wanted to thank you for a very cogent and succinct deliverance. It was extremely interesting and I've been, most informative. But I would like to ask you, what do you think the role, Julian Assange, is something different than daily media, which, frankly, let's face it, most people in this room do not live on a diet of the Herald Sun, and they are limited in their knowledge of what they get, and they get what the government... But the role of journalists these days, I think, is extremely important. And we've got a few old fabulous ones, like Michelle Grattan, who's fabulous, and we are just one country. But there is a problem, isn't it, about the way we are fed the information which is available. And I think you've brought up some amazing issues which have been unanswered about none of us can answer it, the quality of the media. Because just seeing this ghastly television coverage today about what's happening in New Zealand, I mean, the media go mad about issues, and I mean, it's absolutely a disaster. But I've lived in Peshawar in Pakistan, and the tribe, I know a lot about that area, I worked in the Middle East and politics, and we just have fed what very uninformed young journalists sometimes, and I don't want to be ageist. And it's so superficial and so, people quickly scan and think they've got a knowledge. What do you think, how do you feel about the media at the moment and what role they can play and how they should improve?
I think this is very difficult because the short answer is for the media to employ more journalists who can concentrate on a smaller number of topics and keep on top of it. Now, all of the print media worldwide are in terrible commercial situation that online information and bloggers and Twitter and everything else are eating their lunch, and that they're all actually trying to make do with fewer and fewer. So that's a part of the story. There's a commercial story about the problems of the print media in maintaining a decent stable of people who are good enough and who are experienced enough to expect a pretty decent salary. Second thing is there's a yin and yang between the quality of the media and the quality of government. Now, you mentioned Michelle Grattan. People like Michelle Grattan and Laurie Oakes have enough standing that they can refuse to be bullied in the parliamentary press gallery. They can write what they like because people want to read what they write. But the junior journalist, the person early in career who's assigned to the press gallery, can very easily be bullied by being, on the one hand, given the occasional exclusive leak, and on the other hand, being told, you misbehave and you'll just be frozen out, and you won't be able to do your job. So there's a fair bit of thuggery goes on around the press gallery about domestic political reporting, and having a decent stable of people go to the world's hotspots and report in an informed way is expensive. And we're at a time when the print media are in trouble.
Second level of the lies, isn't it?
Yeah, because one way to cut corners is just the top and tail press release.
So, Mike, the one man behind you. Yeah.
Yes. Mark Wigan, I found this most interesting. But one of the things about WikiLeaks you didn't mention is things like the early release of the Act of Text, which allowed the civil society to actually participate. I'm hoping they're going to leave the TPP, because that demo needs it too. There is, seems to be something which you didn't quite say, I think is really important. That is, the trust in government is being declined. The substance of debate is being declined. The use of evidence-based policy now lacks any contestability. And Assange has been an agent to catalyse that. I think the influence is going to extend considerably beyond WikiLeaks, to an indication which you pointed to. Trust in government now is doubtful, and is demonstrably doubtful. So one hopes there's going to be some responses rather than clamping down. If they're listening politically, they should certainly lose it.
I would hope so, but I would say Julian Assange has been more the revealer of the what of how governments don't deserve trust, rather than the agent of reducing.
Young lady.
Hi. We were talking about media just before, and I guess what Julian Assange and Wikileaks really brings up more than anything else is how easy it is for the ordinary person to become a publisher just by a block. How difficult do you think it's going to be to not only have good management of leaks, but to have people take responsibility for what over the internet now that WikiLeaks, whether or not we like the concepts out there, has become crazy?
That's a problem, and it's a problem that exists already with blogs and Twitter and what have you. I've a couple of years ago I was trying to do for a blog which I write on the Iranian nuclear program, and so I looked up Google and I found three consecutive sites that purported to be independent and that were word for word from each other. So yeah. Two of them had scissored and pasted the other, and you'd have to know, did any of them have any properly researched evidence-based statements? So I think you've got to deal with all of the online stuff with the normal care. It's no different from reading a newspaper. Does this make sense? How would they know? You know, give us the evidence trail. The other thing that's happening in Twitter is, which is an enormous source of information, but what I've seen journalists on the ground say is that there are Bahraini government and Libyan government, Egyptian and Libyan government people putting out disinformation. They're using it too. So you've got to. So you can't. This might seem like a Western journal, and it's actually someone from a Libyan intelligence agency. You know, so you've got to be pretty careful. And I think with all information, you've just got to keep it with you.
Did you have a question?
I presume in the same vein, it's only a matter of time before the governments are pushing out their own leaks. The spin doctor of Australia.
Yeah, it'll probably happen sometime in the next minus 50 years. I mean, this is something that over the last few decades has brought our own governmental processes into disrepute. I joined a defence intelligence agency in the mid-60s, and when something had a national security classification on it, it was regarded as absolutely sacrosanct. And and we were told, if anyone asks you where you work, you just say the Department of Defence, and if they ask any further questions, say, sorry, just the Department of Defence. You don't give anybody a chance to ask follow-up questions, and you regard everything as with the classification on it. I can remember people being pinged. We used to have to lock everything up in our safe at night, and then a Commonwealth policeman would come around and inspect all the offices, and I can remember people being pinged for leaving blank paper on their desk with confidential top and bottom, because that's a blank piece of paper that carries national security classification, not for the Commonwealth policeman to decide. This piece of paper says it's confidential. Now, that's just to remind, I mean, it wasn't taken too far, but just to remind people this is serious. Now, what brought all that into disrepute is the habit from Billy McMahon on of ministers and their officers, and now that ministers have large staffs, there's a huge competition to show that my ministers are more clever than yours. So most of the leaks actually come out of ministers' offices. And then governments tut-tut about officials being loose with information. Now, governments have to get back to obeying their own rules if they expect everyone else to obey them.
It's a couple of minutes before seven, and as you know, we always finish right on seven. It's my great pleasure to thank Paul for his speech tonight. He said it was somewhat forthright. I'd love to see him when it was more than somewhat forthright. It was really forthright. A couple of things I'd just like to comment on in relation to it. One of the great changes that have occurred at the federal parliamentary level, I can't speak about the states, of course, but at the federal parliamentary level, when there's a change of government, very often very inexperienced people are put in positions of authority, such as ministers and things like that. They haven't had the background in the parliament that would give them the experience and the maturity to know what was proper and what was not proper. When I first went into the parliament in 1969, if you got from the back bench to the front bench in a couple of years, that was an absolute miracle. You had to serve your time, and you don't have to do that these days. Somebody commented about Michelle Grattan. Can I tell you how Michelle Grattan operates? When I was the Minister for Immigration, Michelle took quite a deal of interest in a number of the matters that came before us. And she would ring me up, seriously, ring me up at about 1:30 in the morning to check whether or not what she was saying was accurate or not. Now, it was a bit off-putting at the time, but I was very glad that she did. And they don't do that these days, unfortunately. What we've had over the last couple of weeks is Ambassador Bleich and Paul Barrett giving us a very different interpretation of the WikiLeaks phenomena. And the ambassador's address will be on the website very shortly, and Paul Barrett's address will be on the website very shortly. If you want to know more about what he said, all you've got to do is respond to his invitation. He runs a blog. Look up his blog, and no doubt you'll be even better informed than you are now. Now, Paul, you've been here a couple of times before. You've probably got our book. but we thought you might like a small libation after.
Firstly, business.
So would you join me in thanking very much? And we will ask him back and make sure that you're aware of all the upcoming events. And most importantly, all of those who are not members, join up. We'd love to see you here more frequently. That closes the meeting. Thank you for your attendance.